Feeling depressed? You're likely not alone, as this is becoming more and more common in our society today. We're going to talk about it and break it all the way down. Welcome to Talking with Docs. I'm Dr. Brad Weening.
I'm Dr. Paul Zalzal.
We have a guest today.
Hi, I'm Dr. Sammy Barakat.
Dr. Sammy Barakat has come with us today. He's a psychiatrist here at our local hospital, kindly offered to give up some time today to discuss depression, what it is, who gets it, and how we potentially can deal with some of the symptoms. So thanks Absolutely. So much for coming this morning, Sammy. Let's start at the beginning. What actually is depression? So it's so much more than just feeling sad.
Right. So depression is a very heterogeneous condition. So it doesn't look the same for everyone. And we also know that depression is a term we use to talk about sadness. So when I talk about depression, we have to distinguish that from sadness. Sadness is a normal part of life experience. Okay. Everyone goes through it. Everyone goes through stressors. Everyone goes through changes. But sometimes there are circumstances whereby your sadness is accompanied by a number of other symptoms. So sometimes you go through significant stressors, losses, and you develop sadness, but you also start to not feel like yourself. And you develop a number of symptoms alongside low mood that is persistent, that makes us concerned that maybe there's something else going on here that is kind of moving from sadness or depressed mood into something that we would call a clinical depression or an illness that needs some attention.
I think that's kind of a big deal because in society we kind of use them interchangeably, right? Say I'm sad, yeah. Oh, I'm so depressed, you know what I mean? But really, medically, there is a very big distinction, it sounds like, between just feeling sad and actually the medical diagnosis of depression.
Yes, that is absolutely true, and especially because people now have access to their own online resources. Mm-hmm. It used to be that people would come in saying, I feel sad. I've been feeling sad lately, something is wrong. Uh-huh. Now people are coming in saying, I have depression.
Right.
Young people, kids, I have depression, I have anxiety. Yeah.
Right.
And you have to kind of tease out what's, again, part of normal experience.
I've been watching Talking with Docs, now I have depression.
No, don't say that. Huh. And what I'd say, I think that brings up the first really important point, is that this is a medical condition. It is not that you're not good enough or that you did something wrong or that it's your fault, that it is a medical condition just like every other medical condition and that it's not your fault and you need to get it dealt with.
Absolutely. There's, you know, that we're talking about a clinical illness
yes.
that needs attention and that is treatable. And so, you know, seeking help whenever you have a persistently low mood or other symptoms, it's very important.
However, if you're feeling that way, you're watching the right video because we're going to talk about how to treat it, how to get help, and how there's hope in this condition.
Absolutely.
And so at what point in someone's life do they say, okay, well, I've been sad for a little bit. When do you go and start to talk to somebody? When do you think, okay, this has become a bit of an issue for me?
So, I mean, what I'll do is I'll give you a little rundown on what the symptoms
Perfect.
Would be, right? So, if you're going through significant stressors, the first thing is you have persistent sadness most of the time.
Okay.
Most of the time, not all the time, not every moment of every day, but most of the time for at least 2 weeks, usually okay. longer than that. It can be a month, it can be 2 months, but it's accompanied by a number of other symptoms. Some of the symptoms are loss of pleasure in things or diminished interest in things.
Which they call anhedonia, right?
Anhedonia. Okay. So the things you used to enjoy, I'll often say, are there things you used to enjoy that you're not getting pleasure from anymore? Or what gives you pleasure? And people will be searching and realizing that, oh, I used to do this, but now I don't. So those are kind of core. You need one or the other or both. Sleep is impacted. So that is most often trouble falling or staying asleep. But in some cases, it can be sleeping too much and still feeling not rejuvenated, unrested, fatigued.
Right.
Guilt, feelings of guilt or worthlessness, low energy, changes in appetite, often a decrease in appetite. But sometimes an increase in appetite. So again, different variants of depression.
Yeah.
One of the core features is also poor concentration. So okay. you lose focus, so trouble with focus, with attention span, with short-term memory. So all of these things are starting to happen together.
Okay.
In addition to sometimes feelings of hopelessness,
yeah.
and sometimes wishes not to be alive anymore.
Right.
So that's an important consideration.
Okay, so sadness accompanied by how many of these other things before you say, is there a threshold? Say if you have two of these other symptoms or three of these other symptoms, or is it just?
Clinically, it's five in total okay. out of the nine that exist. But what I would say is I wouldn't start counting
right.
how many I have.
Right.
The other important thing that describes it as an illness is the importance of, does it interfere with your functioning?
Right.
So it's not just about even just having these symptoms. Is it having an impact on your relationships, on your work, on your occupational life? And do you not feel like yourself? So that's often something we'll talk about.
Right.
Okay. All right. So, and that basically kind of answers your question, Brad. I'm feeling sad, but when do I know, you know, I should go get help with this? And it sounds like if you're sad most of the time, if this has been going on for 2 weeks or more, and or if you have one of these accompanying symptoms that you just
mentioned. Yeah, at least one. There are, I mean, certain core symptoms that, you know, the concentration one, I would say happens in over 90% of people.
Right.
Yeah. You know, the ability, the trouble thinking, the trouble with functioning, they kind of go hand in hand. But again, it's if any of these things start to creep in and are persistent and impact your functioning, it's time to at least seek some help.
And before we get to the diagnostic tools that are going to be used and ruling other things that could look like this, at what point does normal grief become a problem? So say you've had a severely traumatic loss, like whether that's a job or a marriage or heaven forbid a child or something significant, obviously after 2 weeks, you likely are not going to be over some of these types of events. So when does someone say, well, this is kind of going on past what we would consider normal grieving?
So I would say, yes, bereavement is a different condition altogether.
Okay.
So yes, the loss of someone,
yes,
the loss of a spouse, the loss of a child, the loss of a loved one, absolutely can trigger sadness. Symptoms of what we call an adjustment disorder or bereavement. But again, if those other symptoms start to creep in and you're not feeling like yourself ongoing,
right,
beyond weeks and weeks, it can, you know, it can morph into what we call complicated bereavement.
Okay.
Which is kind of a term we use for a depression of which the major stressor is a loss.
Okay,
so that's kind of like, in other conditions we have this too, you'll have a trigger that kind of sets off that other medical condition.
Right.
So same thing here, it can happen on its own, or it can happen by being triggered by something.
I think it's an important point to make that just because, you know, people will explain away their depression.
Right.
Of course I'm depressed. I just had this loss, or I just lost my job.
Right.
So of course I'm depressed. Yes. So all of those things can be stressors. Those things are real, can have real impact, but they can also be part of the triggers for a depressive episode. So again, we need to be vigilant to kind of what is happening, how long does it last, and do these other symptoms start to come at play? The other thing I'll add is, of course, it can't be due to the impact of a substance or a general medical condition. So, you know, those things can trigger depression that still needs to be treated, but in terms of calling it a major depressive disorder or clinical depression, you usually want to rule out the possibility that some other substance or condition is causing it.
Okay, so I'm feeling this way. I've been sad for a while, and I may have one of the other symptoms that you described, and it's starting to interfere with my work or life at home, and I'm going to go seek professional help. What can I expect is going to happen to me when I finally take that leap and go see a specialist or a doctor or a healthcare provider about these symptoms?
So one thing that's important to recognize, this is a common condition, right? 1 in 7 people will be impacted by this at some point in their life. So in terms of destigmatizing this, there's this fear that I'm embarrassed to go talk to my family doctor, my primary care provider, or my healthcare provider about this. But it's important to recognize that this is common. So they will have seen this before. They will be expecting to see this. So you can feel comforted in knowing that when you go to that healthcare provider, they've dealt with this before.
Okay, that's good.
So that's an important point.
Yeah, thank you for that, because that's what we're trying to do on this channel. We've normalized just about anything you can think of to remove stigmas with other conditions.
Yes.
Okay, so yeah, you're going to go see your provider.
And they're going to ask you these types of questions. They're going to ask you how you're feeling. And you're going to, you know, explain what's been going on. And then they're going to ask you about the symptoms, probably go through kind of those core symptoms that I talked about, how long it's been going on, asking you about other substances you might be using to cope, asking you about sleep, importantly, because insomnia is a big risk factor as well. And then they might, if they're kind of using kind of measurement-based care, we call it, give you a couple of screens, a couple of tools to kind of delineate what kind of symptoms you've had in a more objective way.
Can we talk about those? We actually can post them, even a link to them, like a questionnaire where your healthcare practitioner is going to, you know, provide this survey for you or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Which ones are most commonly used to?
So I would say that in primary care and even in our office, the most commonly used ones are the Patient Health Questionnaire 9.
Okay.
For depression, so PHQ-9. So that's a series of 9 questions scored 0 to 3, a total score of up to 27, in which you are really just over the last few weeks grading the symptoms that we've talked about, how severe they've been and how much it's impacted functioning. The second one that usually would be given is called a GAD-7, which measures anxiety. Because depression is so often comorbid, as we say, with anxiety. They go often go hand in hand. So it would give your healthcare practitioner a really good sense of what those symptoms would be. It also sets a baseline for treatment.
Right, and that's so, the PHQ-9 is like a 0 to 3, where the 0 is that I'm never feeling this way, and the 3 is all the time, and then 1 and 2 are somewhere in between, occasional or most of the time.
Absolutely.
You mentioned something really important there, I think, for a lot of our viewers, and maybe that'll be a whole other video, but just the the association with anxiety, where you mentioned it was like a comorbidity. So depression and anxiety often present together, often related to each other.
Absolutely. So they can present together. One can follow the other. But, you know, we say that, you know, 60 to 90% of people with depression will also have anxious features.
Oh, wow.
That doesn't mean they have a full anxiety disorder, but they will have anxiety as part of that picture, and it can complicate the picture. It can also change your treatment approach.
Right.
It can change your impact. So we always want, whenever we have someone who presents with depression, we always screen for anxiety, among other things.
Okay, so if you're feeling that way, if you've got depression, oh my God, I have such bad luck, now I have anxiety too. 90% of the time, there's some associated anxiety with depression.
So up to 90%, yeah. 60 to 90%, I would say.
Okay, now before we get to treatment side, who gets it? So we mentioned the stat of 1 in 7 people are going to experience a depressive episode in their life, a significant depression. Who's getting it in 2025, and has it changed over the course of your practice?
I would say that there are certain, you know, static risk factors.
Okay.
So if you, a family history, if you have a genetic vulnerability, a family history to depression, you're more likely to be at risk.
Okay.
We know that women get depression more than men.
Okay.
We know that the loss of someone in your life, often the loss of a spouse, can be a static risk factor as well, its own kind of category. And then there are a number of kind of what we call potentially non-static risk factors, right? So chronic physical conditions, medical conditions that are comorbid can put you at risk.
Like severe arthritis or cancer or something like that.
Yes, chronic pain conditions, substance use, having another psychiatric condition can put you at risk as well. So there are other substances, as I mentioned, can put you at risk. So there are a number of things that trauma, something that happens to you in those conditions, can also put you at risk. So, but what I would say is, though those are the kind of the things we look for, but any life change is a time where people may be at risk, right? So for women, right, the reproductive years, perimenopausal changes, having children, retiring, any kind of psychosocial change can also be a time where there are good things that come, but also things that are unexpected. So all of those things we kind of look for.
Age distribution wise, would you say that it's like, obviously, as you near the end of your life, that might be something that could lead to depression? Would you say that there are specific spikes as far as like ages where people see more depression?
The most commonly, when if we're talking about major depressive disorder, it's usually kind of 25 to 35 age range. But there can be spikes, again, around the reproductive years for women, sometimes as people get older as well.
Right.
But there are, you know, the younger the age of onset, the more risk of a more severe depression.
25 to 35, so, as far as diseases go, that's in the younger end of things. You know what I mean? Typically, we think if something's going to go wrong, it's going to be later on in life.
Yeah.
25 to 30 is a young population.
Yeah, I mean, these are usually conditions, again, that become lifelong conditions, but somewhere between 25 and 40 is usually when they come on.
Just as a slight aside, I mean, you mentioned how chronic pain and different medical conditions, such as chronic pain, can lead to depression. Is there any evidence, or in your experience, do you find that the presence of depression makes it harder to treat, like arthritic pain or chronic pain?
Absolutely. So, what we're learning now is, you know, we used to talk about, you know, the stigma of this is in your mind versus this is your body is gone, right? We, you know, our brains are part of our bodies. And so we're learning more and more that the things that lead to depression also lead to other things.
Right.
So those patients who have depression also are at a higher risk of chronic insomnia disorders, that are higher risk of cardiovascular disease. Obesity puts you at more risk of depression, but depression puts you more risk at obesity, right? There's a whole kind of neuroinflammation hypothesis that's gaining steam around the nature of these conditions. And some of the things that might lead to pain conditions are some of the similar things that might complicate a depressive picture.
Okay, and that rings home for us because we're often in the business of treating pain. And you know, empirically, we've seen that, you know, over the years. You're like, wait, what's going on here? Is this really the arthritic knee? The x-rays don't look as bad as your pain is. So it's good to know that there are other factors at play here.
It's just important to always kind of stay away from the idea of, well, this can't be the pain. You're feeling it too strongly. This must be in your head, right?
It,
you know, that's outdated, it's antiquated, right?
Yeah.
So you treat what's in front of you, people are at risk for different things. So As opposed to explaining it away, you treat.
And I'd say that's the thing in my office I've said a million times. Listen, it doesn't look like it's your hip, and I'm certainly not minimizing or negating the fact that you are experiencing pain. I believe that you are experiencing the pain.
Yeah.
I'm just not exactly sure what the cause is, or this doesn't appear to be the cause at this time, kind of thing. So, yeah, I agree. Validating for sure goes a long way.
Elegant way to say it. Okay. So now you know what's gonna, you know what you're looking for with the symptoms and what you're feeling. You know what's going to happen when you go see someone about it, all right? And hopefully by now you feel like this is totally normalized. But now we want to talk about, can we jump into some treatment options that are available?
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
So it depends on, just like anything, it's about severity, right? So mild, moderate, or severe depression. If it's mild, there are options in terms of evidence, right? There's some evidence, there's level one evidence, we call it, that exercise can have a significant impact.
Love
so,
it.
But it's not, but exercise in terms of evidence is 30 to 40 minutes, four times a week of moderate intensity aerobic exercise, right?
Okay.
Can have an impact on mild depression.
Right.
Eating healthier can help depression as well. And certain psychotherapies, evidence-based therapies alone for mild depression can get the job done.
Right.
If it's beyond mild depression in terms of mild symptoms, then often you're looking at a combination of therapy, lifestyle changes, and medication.
Okay. So when it comes to exercise, before we go to the moderate side, we've obviously, psychiatry is founded in a lot of the chemicals of our brains. So
right.
People know the word serotonin. People know about dopamine, and they may know about norepinephrine. What is it about exercise that seems to alter that kind of stuff? Is it increasing the amounts of these? Is it making our receptors more sensitive? Like, what is it about exercise that makes us feel better?
That's an interesting question. Does it have to do with endorphins? I think it has to probably do with those neurotransmitters you've talked about, activating them.
Right. But we don't really know.
We don't really know.
Yep.
A lot of what we do is discovery by
trial.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I think that's important. The other thing is, you know, we're talking about kind of what the evidence base is, but when someone's sitting in front of me, it's not about, you need to go out and do 30 to 40 minutes of, if you've done nothing, that's not happening and it's not realistic. So when I'm sitting with my patients, it's, what can you give yourself?
Yeah.
Can you go out for a brisk walk for 10 minutes a day?
Yeah.
Can you do that 3 days a week?
Yeah.
Whatever you can do is better than nothing. And so that's a starting point.
That's
the reality. There's the evidence, but then there's the reality.
Yeah,
but those walks alone are not going to treat depression.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can't walk it off.
No.
You can't walk this one off. Okay. So we got the mild, those lifestyle modifications in terms of eating healthy and exercise can help. And then you get to the moderate, and now you're getting into some lifestyle, medication, and therapy, that sort of triad of things that you're
doing. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, behavioral activation, lifestyle modification, exercise that you can do, those are core hallmarks for any kind of, for mental health in general.
Right.
So that's going to be an important discussion to have. But beyond that, then you're starting to have discussions about medications that can help as a foundation of the treatment to treat those core symptoms. And if you're moderate to severe, is that happening in combination with therapy? Is it medication to get a foundation and then sequentially you're starting therapy? But it's often ideally a combination of those two.
Okay, now in terms of medication, the answer to this may be no, but can you explain it in a way that two orthopedic surgeons could understand just in terms of the type of medications that are available broadly, and we don't need like any super duper details because remember we're orthopedic surgeons.
Yes, but how they work so people can understand why would I take this pill and then it does this.
See, the idea behind this, we call this the monoamine kind of hypothesis, right? You talked about the three main neurotransmitters. So an entire school of thought has come from the idea that there are chemicals in your brain that are out of whack, so to speak, right? For whatever reason, something psychological, genetic has triggered those chemicals to shift in such a way that you're getting too much of one, not enough of one, and that the medications that you take help to return you to the to a natural balance that treats those symptoms.
Okay. So if you're looking at broad classes, where would the average family doctor or psychiatrist start for like a, if there's such a thing, like a garden variety depression? That sounds so almost insulting of a term, but it's someone that's not like in crisis mode, obviously, but you're starting to have the conversation about medication. Where would you start?
So most commonly, primary care practitioners, doctors will start with a class called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
Okay.
The SSRIs, those are the ones you most commonly hear about in the public out there, right? Started with fluoxetine or Prozac way back in 1980. Now there are a number of different medications that people use, but that is often kind of the first go-to. Should it always be the case? Not necessarily.
Okay.
But it is often the first class of medications. What I would say is that there are a number of different medications across a number of different classes, we say. So really, it should be kind of patient-centered, right? Of course. Mm-hmm. Your doctor should be able to kind of talk to you about the options, talk to you about the potential side effects, and work with you to determine which of those medications is the best fit for a first trial.
Okay.
Knowing there's no way to predetermine what medication is going to work for you, unfortunately,
right.
yet. So
right.
what you're doing is you're trying a medication, you're building up slowly to the therapeutic dose, you're increasing as needed, but you're keeping an open mind for what's needed after that in terms of changes, add-ons, et cetera.
And I'm assuming, too, someone is going to be months or years getting to the doctor, like you're accepting the fact that you have this condition that needs to be dealt with. So the 4 to 6 weeks of, say, the average SSRI to get to a therapeutic level, people probably get a little impatient and say, listen, this isn't working for me.
You know,
I want to try a different one.
So two concerns, right? A, they start to have some initial side effects that we know can get better over time.
Oh, okay.
But they don't stick with it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
B, the stigma is still the challenge, right? They really don't want to be on medication, so they're not compliant, right? They're not taking it every day. They're forgetting often. It's hard to remember.
Sure.
To take medications.
Well, plus, if you've got depression, some, you know,
absolutely,
all of those things might be such that you can't take it every day.
And you have to be patient, right? So I'm not saying you have to take a medication for 3 months at one dose and wait it out. Like after 2 weeks or so, something needs to shift. A dose needs to be increased. Your healthcare provider should be on top of that. We kind of know that every 2 weeks is a time for reassessment, ideally. But, and you have to, yes, you do have to be patient. You have to kind of work your way up the doses. But we do know that after a certain amount of time on a certain medication, if nothing is happening, it's probably unlikely that suddenly something magical will happen at the higher dose. You want to see some incremental gains to keep working your way up or consider a switch. Go ahead.
So you have to be a patient.
I know you were.
The other thing I often say around medications is be open-minded what's necessary, right? So, you know, depression is a medical condition like other medical conditions. So when you have someone with high blood pressure or with diabetes, how many medications are people on to optimize the treatment of those conditions?
It's actually, we know that answer for hypertension is like
2.5. I think Mike Heffernan was saying.
Yeah, so when it comes to depression, the stigma sometimes puts us in situations where a medication is having partial benefit, but not all the way. We don't want to lose the benefits of that medication, but we think another one in combination is necessary.
Right.
But then there's resistance to the idea of, oh my God, I must be so sick if I'm going to be on two.
Can you give us a ballpark of if you look at all depression, how many people who are being treated medically are on more than one medication?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in my world, it's much more common.
Right.
Because I'm a specialist, right? So I'm seeing people when your primary care practitioner hasn't been able to get you to where you need to go and needs some help. So often I'm often using combinations of treatment. And what I would say is it's becoming more and more the norm for especially moderate to severe depression.
Okay.
Because the other thing is the goal is full functional recovery.
Hey,
the goal is not just I want to feel better. It's I want to feel all the way back to normal and be functioning at my level again. And so we get caught sometimes with, yes, this medication has helped. Some of these symptoms are better, and you stick there. But really, we shouldn't be doing that, right? We should be making sure that we're treating to full functional recovery and measuring that in some way.
I think that's a great point. I wasn't sure the answer to it. Like what is the goal? Like, you know, for us, I tell you all the time, when I replace your knee, it's going to be way better, but it might not be perfect. So our goal in psychiatry is more to get closer to perfect, if we can.
Ideally, if we're treating, we're going to do everything we can to try and get full functional recovery and symptom remission that sticks.
Yeah. They're not going halfway like you, Brad.
I go more than halfway. But what is it about drugs then? So other than SSRIs, which for sure in social media and the common world is the most commonly recognized drug, what would be the other bigger classes of drugs that people might recognize for depression?
So there are a number of drugs. There's a class of drugs that are SNRIs, so serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors. They're often used to treat patients who have depression, but also with chronic pain conditions. So there's evidence that they can help in those. There are new classes called multimodal agents that impact a number of different neurotransmitters in different ways. And in terms of add-ons, there are sometimes medications we use for illnesses like bipolar disorder in much higher doses, schizophrenia, that in lower doses as add-on treatment are highly effective in combination with antidepressants. So just to put it out there, I use those medications often.
Right.
But what I say to patients is clearly the dose we're using and the purpose of this medication is to treat and optimize the treatment of your depression. When you go to the pharmacy, they're going to know that that's what it's being used for, even if on the box it says antipsychotic or something this year.
Obviously, a lot of stigma with that word.
Stigma. So you have to have that discussion when you get to that point.
Right.
You can't just say, here's a medication that's going to help, go to the pharmacy. They're going to go on, of course, they're going to go online before they ever go to them and think, oh my God, my doctor thinks I'm psychotic or I'm not crazy. So everything needs to be discussed so that you have kind of an alliance with your patient.
Okay. Lots of medical choices.
Yeah, medical choice. So
I've just tipped the iceberg, by the way.
Yeah.
In terms of course. Medication options, first line options in Canada, there are at least 10 or 12. So, I'm not doing justice to the breadth of medication options there really are.
Well, really, for the purpose of our audience, is we just want them enough to know that there are medications available, varying classes of medications available. If one doesn't work for you, there are others that might, and often, you need more than one, just like hypertension.
In addition to medication, I'm assuming you're going to say that everyone needs to be doing some kind of therapy. What does that look like for people?
So I think there are a number of different ways. Therapy is hard to access depending on where you are, especially it's expensive.
Right.
So do you have benefits that cover therapy? Do you have government services that cover your therapy? But ideally the evidence is for kind of what we call evidence-based therapy. So if you're really seeking out therapy, there are a couple of evidence-based therapies that are, highly effective. One is called cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a series of kind of 16 sessions on a weekly basis, kind of looking at your thoughts and how your thoughts impact your emotions. Another is called interpersonal psychotherapy, often related to those life transitions or the loss of someone. So what I would say is if you're seeking therapy for depression in the most simplistic terms, because it's a complex topic, you want to see kind of an evidence-based therapy that is time limited, that has kind of goals in mind.
Okay.
Now there may need to be some maintenance treatments after that, but really you're looking for something evidence-based.
Okay. And the hope is that your therapist is going to allow you to assess your situation, maybe reframe it a little bit, and then give you some strategies to deal with it.
Yes, there are varying degrees of supportive therapies, etc. The most important consideration is therapy is the therapeutic alliance. That is more important than any kind of the modality specific things we're even going to talk about.
So, you mean like getting along with your therapist?
Absolutely.
Really,
and having a match with the therapist is the most, having that trust is the most important
thing.
Just saying
if your therapist is making you depressed, it's probably not going to work.
If you're seeing your therapist in an ongoing way and you're just not connecting, it's highly unlikely that you're going to say, I really don't like my therapist, but I'm getting better.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's good to let people know that that's okay.
Yeah.
Like you can change a therapist. It doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't mean that you're a failure again. You're like, oh, wow, I'm even failing at therapy.
But what I would say is give it time.
Okay. Yeah.
Allow your therapist to ask the hard questions that no one else is going to ask.
Right.
And if you're averse to those questions, don't blame the therapist. Yeah. It means you have to really, maybe that's the work that needs to be done. And depending on the therapy, this is the place where you're going to be pushed, where you're going to be asked questions that are emotionally sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the hallmark of actually an effective therapy.
You're going
to
be
as opposed to someone who just kind of makes you, builds you up and makes you feel like it's going to be all okay.
Yeah,
and an hour goes by.
That's the kind of therapist you'd be.
Yeah, that's why I'm not a therapist.
You'd be like, hey, way to go.
Avoid the difficult
great work.
Stuff.
Yes. How about those J's?
Don't worry
about that. You might feel angry. You might feel sad. You might cry at therapy, whatever.
Absolutely.
Like you're going to bring up some stuff that is really uncomfortable. Yeah. And if you're not uncomfortable at therapy, maybe you're not.
Yes. Yeah. We talk about work. You need to be able to work through, right? Yeah. You need to be able to get through those moments and trust that there's a method to this.
I'm feeling uncomfortable right now. So it's working.
Okay, so we talked about medications. We talked about therapy. Those would be the mainstays. So can we talk a little bit about things that are kind of less common? Two things I'd like to talk about specifically, we talked a little bit before, ECT and psilocybin or mushrooms, because they're very common in social media. We need to kind of just let you know what the evidence says about these things.
So there are more and more accepted kind of neuromodulation treatments for depression. So two that come to mind are electroconvulsive therapy.
Right.
So been around for decades. The most effective treatment for major depressive disorder is response, 65 to 75, even higher response rates.
In this day.
But because of the way that it has to be set up in a controlled environment, in a hospital with anesthesia, it's usually used when patients are not as responsive to other treatments, right? But it's highly effective, especially the more severe the depression is, if patients have psychotic features, other features that might benefit from ECT. So again, ECT is you know, in a controlled environment. So not like the movies that you might have seen.
Right, not One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Absolutely not.
What everybody thinks of it.
In a controlled environment, you know, patients are given kind of sedating agents, anesthesia, medications to calm their body, and have a very controlled, short kind of seizure.
Right.
And then are woken up and carry on. And you do that 2 or 3 times a week for up to 12 treatments, and it's highly effective treatment for depression. So it's commonly available in many hospitals. It's a common treatment, and so that's an important consideration, that ECT should be an option for you. Another one that's come along neuromodulation-wise, before we get to kind of some of the experimental stuff, is repetitive transcranial magnetic stimulation. So RTMS is a kind of newer neuromodulation that has high evidence for the treatment of treatment-resistant depression that is available more and more. In which a kind of magnetic coil is placed on your scalp, and magnetic pulses are activate neurons within your brain, and by some mechanism that treats depression.
Wow.
And so that is an everyday treatment.
Oh.
5 days a week for kind of 6 weeks.
As an inpatient, or sorry, as an outpatient?
Purely as an outpatient.
Okay.
It's available kind of in certain provinces it's already covered, unfortunately not in the province we're in here in Canada, but, and so it's available in outpatient often.
Okay.
And we do it, and we offer it every day in this hospital.
Yeah,
we have a number of patients every day that get it, and it can be life-changing for patients that haven't responded to other
treatments. And it's almost like the cardiac ablation, or like, you know, shocking a heart. You're just essentially shocking the brain to
You were going to say Control-Alt-Delete.
No, like an electrical reset. Of the brain, because I'm assuming we don't totally understand exactly why this works.
Yeah, not fully, but we do know that it's effective.
Yes.
And so, again, if you're out there trying to get your depression better, keep an open mind to all the evidence-based possibilities that exist. And work with your healthcare practitioners to pursue them.
So now Brad's weekend recreational drug question, he's been dying to
ask. No, because I feel like mushrooms are impacted for everything. Everyone says, take a microdose for this, take a big dose for this.
Yes.
It's like a good cure-all with, generally speaking, very poorly researched results. What is the take from a psychiatry point of view?
So what I would say, this is not my field
of
work. I'm a general psychiatrist working in a general community hospital. Yeah. But from what I know, there's promise.
Sure.
In some of these treatments, whether it be psilocybin-assisted therapy or MDMA-assisted therapy, there is growing evidence and research being done in reputable institutions that suggest that this is a pathway forward at some point in time for us. We already are accepting that ketamine, either intranasally or intravenously, there are ketamine clinics where intravenous ketamine. And now intranasal ketamine can be effective treatments for depression and suicidality.
Right.
So that's already out and the evidence is present. So, you know, there's more and more research being done into some of these other substances. But again, it's not simply come in, get the infusion and do nothing else. It's always accompanied by some sort of therapeutic intervention.
Right.
Does that now justify why you're growing these next to your kale?
Oh, my. Okay, before we finish, because we're nearing the end of this video, I think we'd be remiss not to talk about those severe cases where people get to the point of feeling hopeless, feeling suicidal or interested in self-harm. What's our message for those people?
So, I would start before that in terms of saying, look, one of the symptoms of depression can be suicidal thoughts. So, and that doesn't necessarily need to be, I'm going to kill myself. So even if you're having thoughts of, I wish I could escape, or I wish I wasn't alive anymore, that is enough to kind of be aware that you should be seeking attention for that.
And immediately?
I'm not saying that's an emergent thought, but at least recognize that could be a symptom of depression.
Okay.
Don't be afraid of that. And certainly for healthcare practitioners that may be watching, that is enough to meet the criteria. It doesn't have to be something dramatic, like I'm going to go kill myself.
Right.
But certainly as you know, if you start to develop increasing suicidal thoughts, active thoughts of hurting yourself, or a plan, and again, I want to distinguish between thoughts of self-harm, which are a completely different topic, and thoughts of wanting to end your life, right?
Okay.
So if you are having thoughts wanting to end your life, that's an emergent situation, right? So I'm seek help from a healthcare practitioner, but if you start to develop a plan or an intent to follow through on something, that's when it becomes more urgent, and you should be calling a crisis line or going to your nearest emergency department. But don't be... I would put out there, having thoughts of not wanting to be alive means seeking help. It doesn't mean this is emergent, I need to be waiting in my emergency department. Right. It's only when it moves beyond that. And the threshold for seeking help should be low. If you start to have those thoughts, and they are becoming more persistent, you need to seek help.
And don't be like, don't let embarrassment, shame, or anything like that stop you from getting the help you want. Because as you said before, the healthcare professionals have seen this before and even said they're expecting to see this on their shift today. It's nothing new for them.
Absolutely. So. There is nothing new under the sun when it comes to these types of things. So just bring yourself forward and seek the help that you need.
And it's like if you're at home and you took your blood pressure and it was 240 on 160. That's not your fault. You need to go get help. So it's the same kind of problem. And I think that's part of this channel. And thankfully, I feel like our society is a little more open to it. We talk about it a little bit more than we did 30 years ago. And some of the stigma has been removed. But yeah, I think that's one of the take-home messages for today. Sammy, that's an awesome summary.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you. So you're the first psychiatrist we've had on this.
Well, I'm happy to be here. 9 years, your first one.
Right? Amazing. So please leave a comment. Let us know what you're thinking. If you like this video, if you have any other ideas, then maybe we can bring our psychiatrist back to answer down the road. That would be great.
And if you like this video, please like it. Subscribe to our channel. Share it with someone you think could benefit from this information, because there are lots of people that can.
And remember, you are in charge of your own health.
And thanks, Dr. Barkow, for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
We'll see you next time.